AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Music and spirituality. We're very fortunate today on Keeping the Faith to be able to be talking by phone with the internationally known composer and choral director, René Clausen. Welcome, Professor Clausen.
Hi, it's nice to be with you.
We have a good connection. I'm so pleased. And we also have in our studio the director of the chorale here in Champaign-Urbana, and Julie has been the director for how long now?
Forever.
Okay.
27 years, actually.
And I've only been singing with the group for 1 year, so I'm very pleased to be joining the director, Julie Beiler, next week when Professor Clausen is going to be a guest conductor for a festival workshop here in Champaign-Urbana that concludes with a concert at Wesley United Methodist Church on the corner of Green and Goodwin in Urbana, a free concert Professor Clausen will be directing his own music that he's composed. I'm very excited to be able to interview you as well on this program in advance of that. So tell me, you just do this every weekend when you're not teaching at Concordia?
Oh, no. But it seems like in increasing amounts there is that amount of time that I'm spending away from home. So trying to find that balance is always a touchy issue. But I enjoy it a great deal.
And you, of course, perform regularly, directing your own choir at Concordia College, which is also just one of the best a cappella ensembles in the country, if not the world. So you're able to handpick those music students to be part of that 75 voice choir, and they're all upperclassmen, right? You don't allow freshmen in, so you get to hear them for a year and decide who would fit.
It's a very wonderful tradition at Concordia, where we are very fortunate on many levels. First, to have had a wonderful choral tradition that has spanned practically the entire time the college has been there. The choral program has been a significant part of the college, and so as a result of that, we also get a lot of administrative support. Which is, for any choral program, you know, is critical, or any kind of program. And then we are able to attract a lot of singers who are particularly fond of singing in choirs. So I am very fortunate that, yes, I'll be able to pick and choose those singers on an annual audition basis every fall from sophomores and older. So, as a matter of fact, with November 1st today, it's been just about a couple of months that we have the new choir in place. That's been a wonderful fall already.
And you're getting ready for your big Christmas concert, which is a real tradition at Concordia for 80-some years, six concerts, both in Moorhead, Minnesota, and also in Minneapolis. 20,000 people will come and hear you, plus your broadcast on in National Public Television.
You are well prepared. That's correct. We will have six concerts. We'll have four here in Moorhead, and we're actually taping for PBS this year, and then two additional concerts in Orchestra Hall in Minneapolis. It's one of those long-breathed Midwestern choral traditions, among many other schools of our ilk also. But Concordia Christmas is a very special time. And by the time we get to November 1st, there's usually an increasingly larger knot in my stomach that starts to develop about this time, especially when we do television. But one day at a time.
Large orchestra, and how many singers?
See, this year, I think we have about 370 singers.
Wow.
And 5 choirs and 92 in our top orchestra. So that's, I guess that's around 465 performers, I guess. I haven't done that math, but something over 460 performers. And that's a trick, but to get them all in the orchestra hall stage in Minneapolis.
And hopefully playing together.
Yeah, that's always the goal. Yeah.
Julie.
Start and stop together.
Julie Beiler here has 70 voices she works with and orchestras from time to time, and it is exciting to see one person try to pull all those folks together in unison. And that is the theme for the chorale's season this year, in unison, trying to get people to work together for a common good, a common goal. How did you pick that theme, Julie?
Well, every summer I have faced with this dilemma of what to choose. And first of all, I should say hello, Renee. We haven't spoken.
Hi, Julie. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Yes, me too.
Don't have it snow down there.
Oh, no, no, no. That's only Minnesota. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll have it be good for you. In unison was the idea. When I began thinking, after 27 years, first of all, you begin to wonder if you aren't repeating yourself in time and time again. But I think about the in unison, musically speaking, but also what it is to be in unison, to come into a room, as we do every Sunday evening, and for the express purpose of making wonderful music. So not only do we come in to be in unison harmonically and dynamically and pitch and rhythmically and all of those hoped-for items, but we come with one spirit, one intention, from a very diverse group of people, as you well know, Steve, culturally, and we don't vote the same, and we don't go to the same church, and some of us don't pray, and just a lot of diversity. But the unison factor is what I think is the very first beginnings of the spirituality of the sense of a group coming together.
Professor Clausen, you were recently given a huge challenge with the commission you received to that resulted in your choral piece, The Memorial, when the American Choral Directors Society commissioned you to write something in response to the 9/11 tragedy in this country. And yet, in rehearsing that piece, I've been moved by the use of 4 different languages, 4 different words for God in Arabic and English and Hebrew and Latin. How did you get a unison piece out of that diversity?
Well, it's a good question. You do your homework. You're singing the piece. I forget that the same man that is interviewing me is also singing. So that makes a wonderful connection. You know, when I first was approached by Gene Brooks to write Memorial. I was actually conducting in New York City another event, and I got a call from him and asked if he would have breakfast. And I didn't know at that point that that's what was on his mind. And so that's when he presented me with the idea, was that kind of the next morning at breakfast. And it was obviously the convention, the ACDA convention, in 2003 was scheduled to be in New York City, and it was surely by happenstance that was the first convention after 9/11, because New York City was scheduled well before the events of 2001. So it was kind of an interesting circumstance, first of all, that the national convention after 9/11 would be there in New York City. And so in the context of the conversation, first he asked me about being the Raymond Brock Commission composer, which is a huge honor for me. It was something that was kind of a curveball. I did not see this coming at all. So he first asked that, and then it suggested the idea of a 9/11 response or a 9/11 piece. It was very interesting in that it didn't was it kind of soft-pedaled that whole issue. It was a little tenuous in asking, you know, how do you would you be willing to write about that event? And immediately when he thought about that, I said yes. And then it dawned on me later what a fool I was. Because it is one thing to say you're going to write a piece, a major piece, about the events of 9/11, and another thing to do it.
What a weight on your shoulders.
Well, yeah, and I think the initial thought that I had was, you know, first you're trying to buy the idea of writing this commission piece, and then that's a very both evocative and provocative subject. And I think I kind of gave an answer of course, I'm honored. I'd love to do this. And it wasn't until I really started into the process of trying to design in my own mind. I mean, when you look at that, how do you write about that kind of event? Where do you even start? If you're writing a Requiem Mass, you've got to prescribe text. If you're putting together a libretto for an oratorio or whatever kind of large work or a work of some significance for chorus and orchestra, you would look at text. And this was a very blank sheet of paper when I started this whole process of determining, well, what kind of puzzle pieces am I going to make this piece out of? What is it going to be about? And so that was a very interesting time in my life when I had made the commitment to do this, and then began the long and rather arduous, sometimes gut-wrenching process of deciding, well, how am I going to write an extended piece about this event?
Now, I noticed the world premiere was at the Riverside Church in New York City, and that's part of the recording that we're going to play a little bit of here in a moment or two, but that was in February 15 of 2003. How much before that did you actually finish and were able to give the music to your choir?
Conversation with Gene in New York took place just about a year before that, in March. So I basically wrote most of this piece over the summer months that previous summer. And then we began, we had actually, the choir had a number of other commitments. We always have a major fall concert and a Christmas concert, as we discovered earlier, that's annual.
So you're having to get ready for that at the same time.
Right. So there were other things on the agenda. And then, as you said, this was in mid-February, and then actually by the 2 weeks later, we were going on tour, on our national U.S. tour with a different program. So there was a lot on the choir's plate to learn. So basically we were learning the piece. We got it to a point where we could basically sing rhythms,
yes,
kind of notes and rhythms by around November 1st, about this time of year. And then we put it away, kind of, you know, got our feet wet with the piece so that the kids had a basic understanding of it, could essentially sing the piece through. We didn't put it with the orchestra or anything like that. And then put it away until after the Christmas concert. So it was right around January 1st where we began in earnest. And so it was that month of January, which I always say, and you have to kind of know northern Minnesota choral singing to understand this, but the choirs are made here in Minnesota in January.
Sure.
Because, you know, we rehearse from 4:30 till 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and in January, it's pitch black by,
sure,
4 o'clock.
Sure.
You know, it's you might be leaning into the north wind and and the temperature below zero. So that you have to keep warm by singing for an hour and a half every day.
People are grateful to be together, I'm sure.
It is that time when we are most intensely preparing for a tour program, and in this case, for Memorial. It was that 5 or 6 weeks from January 1st.
Before we hear a short cut from Memorial, as recorded by the Concordia College Choir, directed by Renee Clausen, let me reintroduce our guest. Renee Clausen is a professor at Concordia of Music in a named chair there. He is also a composer and the composer of this piece in memory of the victims from 9/11. Julie Beiler is also in our studio. She will be joining in the workshop this coming weekend at Wesley United Methodist Church. And I might just mention that it's still possible for singers to join the festival chorus, the festival choir. You can come to a rehearsal on Friday morning about 8:30 till noon. There'll be a lunch provided, and then the rehearsal Saturday afternoon with 1 to 4:30 with Professor Clausen both times. And then Sunday afternoon, there'll also be a rehearsal at 4, and then the concert will be at 7. So there'll be a lot of music to learn, but your music is provided, and for $40, you can join the chorale, which is sponsoring this and has been raising money for this wonderful event for about a year or so. So we're quite excited to have Professor Renee Clausen as the director and guest as well as composer. Let me remind listeners that this is a live call-in show here on WILL. AM 580, and if you'd like to ask a question to either of our two guests or both about music and spirituality, do give us a call. Anywhere the program is heard, including on the internet, and that can be anywhere in the country, 1-800-222-9455 is the phone number. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, it's a local number, 333-9455. And our engineer, Kyle Crow, will answer the phone and put you in a little line to get on the air live with our two guests. But let's do go to a cut from a memorial. But Julie Beiler, will you tell us a little bit about why you selected this particular one? It's a particularly interesting piece.
I sure will. First of all, I have to say, don't anybody come Friday morning. Come Saturday morning.
I made a
because
mistake.
I think that'll come as a surprise to Renee, too.
Saturday morning.
Well, when I first heard the piece, and I heard Renee talk about it, actually, before I heard the piece in total, and I wanted to do it all, and he said, oh, no, you don't. It involves too big an orchestra, and he must have read between the nonprofit lines of our budget and known what I meant. So then I said, well, let's just do the last section, because although this piece is really written in continuity from beginning to end without stopping, there are clearly four sections. And the last section was the section that began with the Kyrie, which we did as an individual octavo, and we took it to Italy with us several years ago when we went. And I said, well, maybe we can start here. And then I gradually began turning the pages backward, and then I found the place where the choir sings, may I be peaceful, may you be peaceful, may we be peaceful, may we live in joy. And I said to Renee, how can I not do that? And he said, well, so I'm sure he'll tell you that I caught him at a weak moment, I think was his phrase, when he said he would reorchestrate these last two sections so that it would most represent some of the orchestration that we're going to use in a new creation, so we wouldn't have to go out and have a whole lot of different musicians. But I chose it because it's so incredibly powerful to me, the bringing together of the, not just as he speak about the I, the you, and the we, but then the they, which to me implies that there are those who still, as we know, are at war with one another and are not part of the we. And may we live with ease of heart, words that I hold to this day, and may we live in joy. So that's why this little, and it seems to be just scooped out of the middle here, but and over the top you will hear the baritone soloist, in this case, Peter Halverson. And in our case, it will be Jay Ivey from the Eastern School faculty.
Professor Clausen, any words of introduction before we hear this section of from Memorial?
Sure, just maybe a couple quick things to help your listeners know what they're going to hear. Julie outlined the text there very effectively. Just to let you know where that idea came from in this section of the piece, first of all, the whole piece, three-fourths of it, deals mainly with the idea of trying to find common ground. That's the point of the piece, although the first quarter of it or so does begin with a painting of September morning and then the music of the destruction, which is very big and very much a part of the piece. It doesn't dwell there for a long period of time. This section that you're going to hear is based on a Buddhist tradition, actually, that I read in a book. It was a collection of essays that was written by writers, thinkers, about 30 different people who wrote a 4- or 5-page essay on their thoughts after 9/11. This one happened to be a female Buddhist monk who wrote about a tradition in Buddhism called a metta meditation. And a metta meditation has several levels. It begins with the meditation, "May I be peaceful." And then in ever-expanding concentric circles, it expands away from that. "May you be peaceful. May we be peaceful." And so when I read that, I understood the structure that I wanted this section to have. It suddenly made sense then that I could use the idea of a Buddhist meditation and this three different levels to propagate the musical structure of the piece. So actually, when you hear "May I be peaceful," the first section is in the, and I forget what key is in there, but on each succeeding level, it goes up by a minor third. So there's a kind of rising of an expanding of musical texture that matches this idea of meditation. So I just wanted to say those few words about this segment being based on that idea of meditation, and then the kind of patina that goes over the top.
Really interesting for the chorale, who you spend a lot of your time getting them to follow rhythmically exactly what's written on the page. And then all of a sudden, Renee gives us the opportunity to do this personal, very private meditation, not necessarily in rhythm, but in the structure of the chord. So that's been quite a challenge for us.
Right. It's in musical terms, compositional terms, aleatory or chant music. And my whole goal in doing that was for every singer to really to be praying themselves, to be chanting themselves. And it all fits.
Right.
The pitches fit within a pitch, kind of a pitch cell of congruent pitches that work together.
It's quite wonderful.
Let's hear now a short section. "May I Be Peaceful," sung by the Concordia Choir and accompanied by the Concordia Orchestra from Concordia College, Moorhead, Minnesota, directed by the composer himself, Renee Clausen. a small section from Memorial, composed and conducted by our guest today on Keeping the Faith, Professor Renee Clausen from Concordia College, sung by the Concordia Choir and accompanied by Concordia Orchestra. The acoustics obviously were very good there in the Riverside Church in New York, and I know you may well remember that there are very good acoustics in Wesley United Methodist Church here in Urbana, where you'll be conducting that piece next week. You were here during your PhD days, I read.
Oh, yes. It was. We were in residence 3 years there in Champaign-Urbana area during the graduate school years. So I just remember them as being a lot of hot dogs and macaroni and cheese.
And some good music. Now you.
Oh, yeah. Good music, yeah.
Were you had already composed and had published music by the time you started your PhD work. I believe, if I'm reading the copyrights on some of the music we'll be singing, there's one from 81?
Yes. Actually, the very first one would go back to 1976.
Wow.
When I was just 23 years old, and we had just moved. It actually connects very nicely to where you were in Champaign-Urbana. I was a first-year master's student at the University of Illinois, and I was conducting in the master's class with William Olson at that point, and doing an arrangement of mine in our class. And Jim McKelvey, who had begun Mark Foster Music Company, publishing company, was living in Champaign-Urbana, right there, and Mark Foster was based at that time in Champaign, Illinois. And he happened to be walking past the room where I was rehearsing. And he stopped by the door, and when I was done with the piece, he waited very nicely, and I didn't know him at all, and he said, "Well, what was that?" I said, "Well, this is a piece, this is a little tune I just arranged for, you know, the 10 or 12 singers that we had in the program for the class." And I used it, I'd also used it in a couple of church jobs that I had at that point. And he said, "Well, would you like to publish that?" And, of course, I was 23, and the publisher told me, or asked me, "Would you like to publish that?" And I kind of swallowed hard, and my heart beat faster, and said, "Of course." And that was the beginning of a very long relationship I had with Jim McKelvey and Mark Foster Music Company. He was the gentleman who first gave me a chance to publish. And I think for every composer who's ever published a piece, that first one that you see off the press is a pretty special experience. I've always been grateful to Jim and Mark Foster for that start.
Very exciting. And the piece that you'll be singing, or you'll be conducting, that you wrote next week, All That Hath Life and Breath, Praise Ye the Lord, came out in 81, I see.
Yeah.
Very. Uh-huh. Also very early.
Yeah, that was written actually to, I think I might even say on the music, from the Wichita State University a cappella choir.
Where you were directing at the time.
Yes, it was my first college teaching job out of grad school in Illinois.
Ah, wonderful.
And that's what, so when I went to Wichita State to do my first college-level concert, the a cappella choir there was a group of freshmen and sophomores, so relatively young college students, but nonetheless college students, and I was going to be doing a fall concert with them. And, of course, was striving to make a good impression with my first college choir. And so I thought, well, I'll just write a piece that'll take advantage of their strengths and diminish their weaknesses. So that piece was actually written for that choir. And if you know the piece, the tenor part only goes up to F natural because my tenor section wasn't very good. So it only goes up to F and then just touches over that a couple of times. But I had a sophomore, Ace Soprano, who's a wonderful singer, and so the middle section of that piece, which has a rather contemplative soprano solo, was written for her. So it's interesting sometimes the way a composer will write a piece for a particular choir, for a particular circumstance. And that was the opening piece of the first college choir I ever had.
Mm. It happens the chorale had sung that previously, in fact, at St. Peter's in the Vatican on tour. Julie, tell a little bit about that.
You might be interested to know, Renee, that when we were asked to sing at the Vatican, it was right after the new Pope was...
What a high honor.
It was, but right after the new Pope was installed, and he was doing the 17 Cardinals that weekend. Anyway, I went in and showed the Monsignor maybe 8 octavos at a time because they hadn't given us the approval ahead of time like they said they would. And, I had the Spanish Psalm 150, no Ave Marias, no Aves, no nothing. And he found all that hath life and breath and said, oh, yes, yes. And so we did that, and we did also your Bless the Lord, O My Soul. So
really?
They liked it at the Vatican, I'll tell you.
Well, I will take that as a good recommendation.
Well, that's good. We're bringing in our ace soprano she had the nerve to move to Michigan. I'm unimpressed, but she's coming back down again. So we'll have one for that little place.
I always have a special connection to that piece just because it was my first college group. I was just a kid in my later 20s at that point and was really making the effort to take advantage of the kids I had in my choir. And I still go back to thinking about something that I had a very baritone-y tenor section, just not a lot of high tenors. And it's just curious to think how many times I've done this throughout the years, is you'll write a piece with a particular group in mind. And I think that probably has been true throughout history for...
Even then, though, you had this have this little section where you just send the sopranos into fits by allowing them to enter at random, one at a time.
Yeah. I've always found that a good teaching piece for aleatory, because it's not a difficult contemporary piece, but there's a chance for singers to be independent. As a matter of fact, when I've done all that half, and I've not done it very much, but usually it's a problem to get the singers to be independent. We teach them to be dependent and do everything together all their life, you know.
Exactly right.
Be precise and be clear and be together.
Well, you have another teaching opportunity very soon.
Yeah. Mostly I've done that piece in festivals. I've rarely done it with my own college group. But that's what I found in teaching that piece, is that you have to get them to be independent, and that it's okay.
Right.
Let me remind listeners that they'll have an opportunity to hear some of this music live next weekend. That's November 7 and 8. And since this program will be on our website and archived, this is the year 2009 when this opportunity is happening. This coming weekend, November 7 and 8, Saturday and Sunday at Wesley United Methodist Church. The free concert that Professor Clausen will be conducting is at 7 p.m., and Wesley Church is on Green Street, right on the University of Illinois campus, on the corner of Goodwin and Green. There'll be a lot of free parking around there on Sunday evening. The parking meters are free on Sundays, and parking at the church and also under Krannert Center, there'll probably be plenty of room. So do come to this concert. There'll be 5 pieces composed by Renee Clausen that will be sung by the chorale. And Julie, you'll be conducting one or two as well?
Composed and arranged. And yes, it's very nervy in the face of the composer to presume to conduct one or two. But it seemed to me to be... I'd either have to sing or sit quietly on my hands, and that's that's troublesome. The only piece on the program that is not attached to Renee is the one that we'll open the program with, and that's Walk Together Children, and it's the De Cormier arrangement, and kind of has a little to do with our In Unison theme. But other than that, we'll be doing the arrangements that Renee has written for Oh, My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose. My friend Jean Redpath has reminded me on countless occasions this is the 250th anniversary of Robert Burns' birth, and so on that recommendation, we'll do, besides it's a wonderful arrangement with cello and violin accompaniment as well.
Actually, that's a composition.
Composition, yep, okay.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's specifically not an arrangement.
And can I say, I've looked at this for, a couple years, and I keep thinking, too Frankie. Is it true? Huh. Can I say this was to your wife?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so little did I know that Mary Frances was called Frankie all along. So my group is always interested in that, in the small print above the...
It's a kind of an interesting, quick story, if you don't mind hearing that. But, you know, first of all, it's an interesting combination of names that my name is Renee and my wife's name is Frankie.
Yes, Pat and Mike kind of thing. Huh?
Yeah, but I actually wrote that piece all in one morning on a few years ago. I forget which year it was now, but I wrote it on Valentine's Day.
Oh, very thoughtful.
On a Thursday morning. Actually, I had the poem, the Robert Burns poem, on my desk for a long time. And like many men would probably hate to admit, is that it came to Valentine's Day morning, and I hadn't gotten anything planned, you know, for Valentine's Day for my wife. So I just decided to write this piece. And so I did that morning, and it was before Finale. I didn't know Finale program. I think it was maybe even before that program was available. But I just remember I wrote the piece, and there wasn't violin or cello or any of that that is currently attached to a piece when I wound up publishing it later. But I just wrote out the choral parts, basically, and then I brought it into my choir in the afternoon, and we just read through it once, and I said, hey, well, I will make something up at the piano, and you just kind of follow me, and then we're going to record this. And so that's what happened, is I kind of made up a piano part on the spot, and then we recorded the piece, and then I took the manuscript and rolled it up in a piece of red... ribbon with, and I stopped and got a single rose and put the tape in and wrapped it all up together and brought it home to my wife and said, well, here's your Valentine's Day present. And of course she immediately melted into the floor when I played it for her.
Motivation is a fine thing.
I'm saying that because she's sitting here right next to me, but actually, the problem has been every year, Valentine's Day since then, she said, well, what have you done for me lately?
Peaked too early, did you?
But that was that's always been a special piece to me because it was it's such a beautiful text and such a beautiful love poem. And it's been one of the more popular pieces, as a matter of fact. My daughter is now attending college based on that.
Well, we're glad to help.
And spouses of composers are so kind not to say, what, again, no jewelry?
Right. Yeah.
We're also going to do your piece, I Leave With You. I want you to tell me why that's so difficult for choirs. It's so simple, and yet it seems tricky.
I remember that. Remember the name Larry Fleming? Oh, well, Fleming, wonderful composer, conductor, passed away a few years ago. Did that piece with his National Lutheran Choir, and he called me one day and said, basically that same thing. He said, Klassen, this isn't really very hard, but we're just struggling, you know. But with this piece, I think that the piece is very etched is the issue. It does not move along with any kind of full rhythm. It is largely chordal. It has the underlying sense of movement is more emotional than it is physical. That's rhythmic movement. I think where it begins with the soprano and the isolated third that kind of previews the chord before the rest of the singers enter. It's a very clean piece, and so there's nowhere to hide.
Exactly, right.
I think that is what happens in the pieces. It is very etched, and I mean, when I've done it, actually when I wrote the piece, I wrote it as a piece for our alumni choir here at Concordia, where we have, every several years, we invite the Concordia Choir alums to come and join the choir at homecoming. And now this is really quite a scene when this happens, because there may be 300 alumni singers back, so it's, or more, and so it is a very large chorus. And partly why I set this text is that it's a wonderful benediction. The text itself is a very beautiful benediction, and it's the basic chordal structure of the piece. It's alternation between men and women's textures. It kind of features both men and women, and individually and then corporately. Works well in a big chorus, and so a big choir also can more easily sustain.
Exactly, the air supply is better.
Rather dense texture of the piece, but yeah, I know the opening. I think if you get through the opening few bars, generally, if you're in good shape by the end of the third bar, I think you're home clear.
Well, like you say, with 300 and some singers, the air supply is infinitely better than with 85. So yeah. If I suddenly decide to listen to this and turn it over to you, you'll know why.
it needs to breathe long phrases.
Yes,
and
indeed.
And it's a bit like when I've done this piece, I've said to the choir, you've got to play it like a bagpipe player controls the air through the bagpipe, or a reed player controls the air. You can't let too much air slip away from you.
Well, it's quite beautiful. We're going to do it anyway, and we'll see how it goes.
Well, thank you very much.
And let me mention to potential singers who would still like to sign up to join this festival chorus, this festival choir, next Saturday and Sunday. The rehearsals start Saturday at 8:30 to noon. A lunch will be provided. And then another rehearsal in the afternoon, 1 to 4, 4:30 or so. Sunday afternoon rehearsal at 4 and concert at 7 p.m. at Wesley United Methodist Church. Costs $40. That includes your lunch, the music, and a wonderful opportunity with the composer and conductor, Renee Clausen, and Julie Beiler as the director of the Chorale, which is the organization, the singing organization that will form the nucleus of the choir, but we're happy to have other singers. If you'd like to join, have opportunity to join, do call Julie Beiler. Her phone number is 217-586-2970. Again, that's Julie Beiler at 217-586-2970. Let me remind listeners, this is a live program here on WILL AM 580. And if you've missed part of this program and would like to hear it in its entirety, it'll be up on our website in about a week. And you can access that at will.illinois.edu. Go to AM, click on Keeping the Faith, or put in Clausen, Renee Clausen, R-E-N-E, accent aigu, I think, and Clausen, C-L-A-U-S-E-N. And you can find that in the search box, or you can go to this date, November 1st, to hear this program. Again, if you'd like to call with a question for our composer-conductor by phone or in the studio, Julie Beiler, 333-9455 is the local number if you're listening on the Internet or elsewhere, 222-9455 is the 800 number. So that's 333-WILL or 222-WILL on the 800 line. Well, let's talk a little bit about the spirituality of this music. I know as a singer of it, in being part of a choir, being hearing the other parts all around me, it's very moving emotionally. But how is being moved emotionally a spiritual experience? Do you think of creating a spiritual experience for singers and listeners as you're composing, Professor Clausen?
Well, it's probably an age-old question, and still a good one, about what is the meaning of a music. Does music have meaning? Can music be spiritual? In a very fundamental way, music is vibrations. It's a concord of sweet sounds, hopefully. But in terms of it being a spiritual experience. I think that is so remarkably individual. And, you know, what each singer might bring, or how they relate emotionally, expressively, to singing a piece of music. I do think that often music written to a sacred text, especially music that uses the elements of composition, so melody, harmony, rhythm, form, tone, color, in the case of choral music text, they all construe together to create emotional impact in singers. And especially choral singers who choose to be in a choir, they're often represent, I think Julie mentioned early on, that there's a wide variety of singers in her choir. And they may be from different religious persuasions, from different faith bases, maybe some who have no faith base.
Sure.
Maybe seekers of every kind, and others who are have a kind of strict religious pedagogy about them. I think maybe to answer your question with some clarity, which is very difficult to do.
Of course.
It's a very amorphous kind of
All good questions are hard to answer.
Yeah. But what I would say is that there are, I think the common thread of expression runs through people who love to sing together. And that may be defined in different ways and may be experienced in different ways. But in the community of choral song, there is also unity. They come together for the express purpose of creating music together. Now, that's going to speak to different people in different ways. This is an adjacent subject to this whole realm of spirituality, is what the church, the large church, faces today in terms of worship style between what might be called CCM, or contemporary Christian music, or praise band music, and traditional music. I've kind of shown my prejudice there by not, I don't say traditional music anymore, but serious music. But, one of the difficult questions that arises in the church is, what does it mean? How do we define spirituality and music? How do we know if someone is having a spiritual experience through music? So what is happening now is often churches are dividing over worship style. Those who will worship only in traditional style, or those who will only worship in a style that is either a praise band or again, CCM, if I don't mind using that term. So, and these provoke very, very strong emotions. Music provokes strong emotions. And what I try to do in writing my own music, as a matter of fact, is there's a paragraph that Julie has probably seen at the bottom of the A New Creation, that I was very careful to write, that I don't write music to proselytize any one religious point of view. I just think that's a little pretentious to do that, and a little exclusive. Choral music especially can break down those bars. We don't have to talk specifics of religious canon or theology or how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. Music goes is a wider viewpoint than that. And so, hopefully, When I write music to a sacred text, I'm trying to be honest and true to that text, first of all, to the writer of the text, to try to express what that text is about. I'm very text-centered, as I think most choral composers would need to be, both in terms of the text structure and text content.
And all poets appreciate that.
And so I think that's where you start in setting a text.
I think as a
go ahead.
Sorry, I think as a conductor, what I really hope singers will do is take the text and the notes on the page, which are just that, and inhale them and run them through their system. You know, I think they really has to go through your whole self so that your life experience, whatever it is that you hold dear and value and whatever speaks to you in whatever way, will come out. Because otherwise, I think soulful or spirituality doesn't show. You can have professional singers and the highest degree of musicianship and yet not have that investiture, that ownership and that bareness of soul that comes out when you do digest the whole thing.
And there's something about beauty which touches people regardless of whether they think there's any kind of a God or not. And so I think people can sing and hear something that's beautiful, that's moving, that's true, even if they disagree with that tradition.
This whole act of singing really is quite miraculous. If you look at what it takes to sing, one individual pitch, I remember seeing a National Geographic special one time about this when a scientist took a clear piece of plastic, maybe a foot wide by 6 inches, and constructed a pharynx, carved a pharynx into this clear piece of plastic, and then mounted at the back of the pharynx what looked like bassoon reed, and then connected a black tube to the floor where there was an airstream provided by a machine that pushed a stream of air past the reed that was amplified by the artificial esophagus. And what came out was this duck-like quack of a sound. And what I thought was quite amazing by this demonstration is it took a lot of, I mean, not complex technology, but a lot of different processes to make one ugly pitch. Now, when you think of what singers do, or what they're able to do is to imagine, simply imagine the pitch. The vocal cords are taught to the right tension and frequency of, so that the airstream passing over them will create exactly the right pitch at exactly the right vibration with a hopefully beautiful vowel sound. I mean, that we can do that once is quite amazing, that we can do it in quick succession and then make concord of sweet sound together still is quite miraculous to me, that humans imagine pitch and then somehow we are able to physically do this. Well, I think that's on to something. Just this miracle, yet that we do when we sing. This is the first instrument was the voice, and it is unique as our thumbprint. And when we sing, we risk our personality, which is very different than any kind of player, in which there's always the other medium there. But a singer has to risk everything to sing and to risk their personality to create this sound. So I think that there is just something inborn spiritual feature to singing.
We've talked about creating the music, and one of your pieces we're going to be singing next week is a new creation. Julie, tell us just a little bit about why you chose that.
Well, a quick story. I have to confess that in 1995, I was beating my head against the wall about what to do, and my husband came to me with a box of music. Renee talked about Jim McKelvey and Mark Foster. My husband's first wife, whom he lost to cancer, was the graphic artist for Mark Foster and had done all of this work and had the box full of music that she had illustrated. And he said, here, perhaps you can find something here. And it was there that I first discovered A New Creation, which is just a really dear to my heart. We did it in 96, again in 2001, and we're going to do it again with four soloists, Amy Fuller, Elizabeth Campbell Buckley, Justin Vickers, and Jay Ivey, an orchestra. And again, Rene talked about this little paragraph. I just want to read you the last part of it. He says, a new creation is representative of the composer's belief, and I think even the conductor's hope, that unwrapping all of these elements in the progression of our lives, sometimes with joy, sometimes with pain, is worth the effort.
We've been talking today on Keeping the Faith with two guests, one in studio, Judy Byler, who's the director of the Chorale, and by phone, with Professor Rene Clausen, who is a composer and conductor, who will be here in Champaign-Urbana next weekend, November 7 and 8, 2009, for a choral festival. And let me remind listeners that you may come to a free concert of his music at Wesley United Methodist Church on the corner of Goodwin and Green in Urbana. And singers, if you'd, there's still a chance to join up for this experience next weekend by calling Julie Byler at 586-2970 in area code 217. It'll involve a commitment of Saturday most of the day from 8:30 in the morning till 4:30 in the afternoon, Sunday afternoon rehearsal again at 4, and then the concert Sunday night, November 8 at 7 p.m. $40 to help pay for all the expenses, a small orchestra, and bringing Professor Clausen to this community. I want to thank both our guests for being in studio, Julie, and by phone. Thank you for having a telephone to your ear. I know it's hard for a composer to talk about his own music, but thank you so much for making the effort, Professor.
Oh, it was my pleasure to be with you, and I look forward to making music with Julie's singers. I think that will always be the most fun. Yes.
It is a community choir, and I'm privileged to be a part of that this year, and look forward to singing with you. On Keeping the Faith next week, our guest will be Jess Zimmerman from Butler University. He is a student there who's been sued by the university because of comments he made in his blog. Should be a very interesting question about free speech and ethics. That's November 8 here on Keeping the Faith on WILL AM 580. The following weekend, November 15, our guest will be a couple folks who are part of Peaceful Tomorrows, a group of families of victims of 9/11. So that'll be an interesting conversation. These are people who are working very hard for a peaceful response to that event. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
In March 2003, the U.S. invaded Iraq. More than 6 years later, we're still there. What happened? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, at the best of our knowledge, we'll talk with the planners of the war in Iraq. Architects of War is part two of Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening at 7.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: EAG Company Incorporated, Fairmount, Family Video Movie Club, Springfield, First National Bank and Trust Company, Clinton, and Jarman Center, Tuscola. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.